So thank you, Andrew, and thank you to the review. And I look forward to working with you on this project. I'm going to say a little bit about my larger project, about the book. I figured that's what you were interested in hearing about. But I know some of you might be getting into the weeds as far as sub-inciting or whatever my article. So I will say a little bit about that as well. So I've been working for about 3 years on a book about war powers. It's going to come out next year from Harvard University Press. It's called Long Wars in the Constitution, and they even showed me the cover jacket copy recently. It's really cool. Has pictures of all the post-war presidents, because that's what it's really about. Narrowly put, this is a study of presidential decisions for major wars since 1945. So that's Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf War of 1991, and our favorites, Afghanistan and Iraq, along with a fairly careful examination of the constitutional arguments attorneys for the president made with respect to the constitutionality of each of these wars. Now, that's where the bibliography comes in. I'll get back to that in a second, but my idea from the beginning was no one had ever examined all of the opinions the executive branch has been writing in the post-World War II period to justify what presidents have been doing. And that's of inherent interest, I think, because what presidents have been doing has been quite controversial, and war powers has been pretty consistently controversial as a constitutional topic since President Truman's decision to intervene in Korea, since he made it without a declaration of war from Congress, or indeed without any separate war authorization. We're sort of living in an era where we're a little more familiar with war authorizations, and they arguably, and we had one, the authorization in September 2001, and there was a separate war authorization for Iraq. Arguably, these authorizations started in the 1950s. You can go back and try to find some other examples earlier, but a lot of the earlier examples are literal declarations of war, which we don't have anymore. And so since this practice seems to have gotten started in the 1950s, well, that meant it had some kind of legal justification. And that's where attorneys for the president came in. Now, that's narrowly put. I always intended, in other words, to do decisions for major wars, and I'll just mention that it includes not only these overt wars, but also another aspect of my project was to include decisions for covert war as well. Or, of course, literally covert wars aren't very covert, but nonetheless. So I talk a lot about incidents like the Bay of Pigs and the Iran-Contra affair. Those all fall across my idea of concentrating on presidential decisions for major wars. Now, that's sort of a narrow version of the project. The broad version of the project is that it's intended as an updating, but also really a replacement. And here I'm really being kind of aggressively optimistic. A replacement for Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s well-known book, The Imperial Presidency. Lots of people have heard about the concept of the imperial presidency who haven't read Schlesinger's book. Well, it's kind of old. It was written in 1973. Most of the book is really about Vietnam. That's what Schlesinger was really upset about. He wrote the book, in fact, it's over 400 pages, I think, but he wrote it only a few months in 1973. So prepared he was to write about history. He was a very well-known historian. And he's so mad, he's so angry about what the Johnson and Nixon administrations had done with respect to Vietnam that a lot of the book is about that. But Schlesinger's book started a whole genre. We still have books that refer to, in the literal title, and we still have a discussion happening in terms of the imperial presidency. So although I'm not writing the book to be sort of condemnatory of presidents in the usual style, I was writing the book to sort of cover the same ground that Schlesinger did and the people who write in that genre, but from a different perspective. I suppose what I'll highlight here is that my perspective on war powers is that even though I broadly agree with the people who are called congressionalists, the people who think presidents have been deviating from the original intent of the Constitution, just to make it real simple, I don't think there's any way to go back. There's no way to go back to the original constitutional order and somehow ignore the fact that we adopted a new constitutional order that was sort of self-consciously adopted during the early Cold War. So to an extent, to the extent that presidents have made bad or wrong decisions and since World War II in furtherance of this order, something that many people believe, we're really experiencing a kind of tragedy rather than something that could be easily fixed as a policy problem. My general method was to make the most detailed survey I could of works in diplomatic history on decisions for war with respect to the major conflicts I mentioned. This work is also inspired a bit by work familiar now to constitutional scholars, work like Bruce Ackerman's, that sees the Constitution developing over time through a series of regimes and, or orders. So as I already sort of mentioned, I contrast the post-World War II or Cold War order in the book with the pre-Pearl Harbor order. Now, this is going to be a controversial point because many people now see a little more continuity than difference between the pre-World War II presidents who did intervene many times abroad without ever getting declarations of war and the presidents after. There's a genre of criticism to which I sort of develop and respond to in the book that sees Truman's decision that I've already referred to as very important. And I largely agree with that. But I'm just highlighting to you that history is complicated, and there is a lot of evidence that even presidents before Truman intervened abroad without asking for Congress. All right. Now, I want to a little deviate from describing then the general project to discussing what some of you are going to be working on. What you literally said, what the, some of the junior members might actually be involved with this. So you might be staring at my bibliography and ask yourself, well, what is this thing and why am I working on it? Does that mean, by the way, that the senior members are referred to as SMs? If the junior members are referred to as JMs, okay. Just wondering about that. Well, about halfway through my project, it occurred to me that I couldn't do a good job of analyzing executive war powers opinions unless I had them all. And it further occurred to me, although that there were some leading examples of such opinions, particularly number one on the list, which is the opinion that the Department of State provided after certain people in Congress immediately objected. And you'll notice that it happened quite quickly. The Truman's decisions, you know, about to intervene in Korea were made at the end of June 1950. Just about 2 weeks later, the State Department published this first opinion justifying what he did. That's partly because very prominent members of Congress immediately raised a flag. Some of them didn't really oppose intervening in Korea to stop the North Korean invasion that happened in late June 1950. But others didn't like Truman at all, and they said, well, are we going to launch a major war without asking Congress for permission? So at that point, Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State at the time, one of the most influential Secretaries of State certainly in American history, had the State Department's Office of the Legal Advisor, a very, you know, old and storied part of the department, come up with the first opinion on the list. Well, this opinion is an example of an opinion that was well known and well footnoted. But I began to wonder, were there others? And were they all opinions provided by the Office of Legal Counsel? That's what we're familiar with in the present. Are they all public? And so what I found was, by hook or by crook, that there were a lot of opinions that had never been uncovered before or noticed much. They were referenced here and there in histories of these individual wars, but no one had ever put together an entire list. So simply to do the project that I originally wanted to carry out, look at all these executive branch opinions, I had to construct my own list. And eventually it occurred to me, well, if I had to do this, maybe other people might be interested in the list. Now, I'll talk a little bit about the surprises that I had in constructing the list, but I suppose I'll make a couple of general observations. First, I wasn't trying to do this just from the perspective of being some kind of bibliography hound. What I wanted to do was notice common patterns over time. I was interested in substance, in other words, not just collecting these different opinions. And most of them aren't very long. And so I was looking for, did the executive branch ever settle, in other words, on a well-understood, singular justification for presidential intervention where you could just enumerate the arguments and then examine them? Or did the executive branch's views change over time? Did they introduce new arguments in response to criticism and so on? Well, that part of the project proved a little harder to do than I originally anticipated because a lot of these arguments aren't very long. You could say even that some of them are kind of cursory. But nonetheless, I felt that when studied over time, when you study a sufficient number of them, you can notice patterns. I don't want to keep you in suspense. That wasn't going to be a subject of my talk today. Certainly we can have, you know, questions. But one of the most obvious arguments that is made from the beginning is a reliance on prior practice. That's the most famous argument, arguably, that presidents have always used with respect to war powers. We're doing it, and our predecessors did the same thing, namely intervene abroad without asking for any special permission or declaration from Congress. Okay. So the other general observation is there's a move over time from reliance on the State Department to the Office of Legal Counsel. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department, but it didn't always exist. I can't quite remember when they really started, staffing that department out. But originally the thought was intervening abroad raises questions of international law, in addition to U.S. constitutional law. Hence, it is a matter for the State Department. So you'll see early on, it's all of the opinions are being provided out of the State Department. And the OLC is not involved at all, either because it doesn't exist. We could develop a footnote on this, maybe, as to why they weren't involved. Then my understanding is, although I'm not able to document this, I'll have to go back and look. In the Nixon administration, it was decided that while the State Department should still be used for questions involving international law, that the objections being made to presidential war power are more often sounded in U.S. constitutional law, namely no declaration of war. At that point, the opinion started to be developed much more in the Office of Legal Counsel. And as we get closer to the present, more of these opinions, not all of them, but more of them are public. I suppose another minor difference as you go along is you get the involvement of the White House Counsel's Office. Now here, there's a much better documented history. The White House Counsel's Office is a relatively recent invention, didn't exist until something like the Johnson or Nixon administrations, and it didn't do very much. You know, it offered opinions on whether the president could accept gifts or something, this or that, but it didn't get involved in matters of policy. But as time went on, more and more, and certainly by the Reagan administration, Carter administration, Reagan administration, the White House Counsel's Office was now also involved. Now, those opinions, to the extent they exist, are completely not public. So I was very happy to find some references to opinions that were relevant to the Persian Gulf War. And it is at this point that I actually had to get on the road. So some of these opinions, since they never were published before, and there's no one record of them, can only be discovered by going to presidential libraries. And I was always anticipating this would be the fun part of my project, to get on the road. And I had the intention of going to every presidential library, but it turned out that there wasn't that much evidence that every administration had issued such opinions. So it really came down to, did I have a complete record on Vietnam? Well, I didn't, so I visited the Johnson Library. And there was obviously some gold in the George H.W. Bush Library in college, which George H.W. Bush, he put it in at Texas A&M. Did anyone know that? He put his presidential library in College Station. Has anyone ever been to College Station? I mean, it's out in the middle of nowhere. I don't want to run down Texas A&M. I'm sure it's a fine school, but it's a little odd, I think, that George H.W. Bush just sort of put his library, well, I suppose it's close to Houston, but it's out in the middle of nowhere, really. So I turned up some opinions there, And I had the good fortune of being able to visit the Truman Library. Now, here there was less to discover as far as opinions. Those opinions are very well known. But there were some notes that were relevant to the issue of, was it really Truman's decision, literally, not to ask Congress? Or was this something pushed on him by his advisors, where he just got into a mode of, well, I didn't, you know, it was all very rushed, it's an emergency situation, I didn't ask them, and now it's 2 or 3 weeks later, and there's no... No, I think the evidence supports that it's you're looking at a presidential decision. Truman consciously decided, I'm not going to ask Congress for permission. I want the freedom to decide on my own. It's a more of a controversial point, but that's one also made in my book. So I got to visit the Truman Library, and finally, although I didn't really expect this, I got a chance to visit the Nixon Library. Until quite recently, the Nixon Library was famous for not having anything in it. They had exhibits, you understand, but they didn't have the actual archives because the archives... the boxes, as they call them sometimes, were under litigation for decades because Nixon wanted control, and they were held really at the National Archives in D.C. But just recently, the Nixon Library turned into a real archive that scholars can use. And it was there that I had the most exciting time because I discovered a previously unknown opinion on the War Powers Resolution. Arguably, the War Powers Resolution is the most famous statute in the area of war powers, passed in response to Vietnam in 1973. Nixon has a famous veto message. A lot of your con law casebooks have that veto message or part of it. But where did it come from? What, Nixon wrote it on its own? No, it had to be written for him by some lawyer somewhere, but no one ever tracked down the original opinion, and I don't want to tell you I did either, because I wasn't able to do that, but what I found is, you see, in the normal course of events, after such a significant law was passed, the president would ask his advisors for formal legal opinions, especially in a case of that's arguably intruding on his own powers. From the presidential perspective, you know, they have their war powers as a matter of being commander-in-chief. So they think they have their own set of war powers. So it would have been natural for Nixon to ask his lawyers to weigh in. But as far as I know, no prior scholar had found the underlying opinions on which Nixon had based his veto message. Well, it was very exciting then when I discovered that there was an opinion from the Attorney General at the time, Elliot Richardson, saying, as you might expect, yes, the War Powers Resolution is unconstitutional, but that provided a little more evidence about see how they think and these patterns of argument. That's what I was really looking for. And so it was exciting to find opinions that have never been published before, and that led to my suggestion that maybe we should publish a couple of them as appendices. And, you know, you'll have to be careful about bibliographic assertions like this has never been found before or this has never been published before. But I've been reading in this area for a lot of years, and to my knowledge, the careful legal statement, to my knowledge, when we publish these opinions in the review, this will be the first time anyone's ever seen them. Especially with respect to these, both the Elliot Richardson opinion on the War Powers Resolution and this later opinion by White House Counsel C. Boyden Gray on the constitutionality of the Persian Gulf War, where Bush really wanted to be able to intervene to throw Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait without having to ask Congress for permission. And C. Boyden Gray, you'll see in the memo that C. Boyden Gray reassures him that, of course, you can. Now, the justification for that, the constitutional basis for it, is a whole other matter. And as I said, I'm writing this book from what I consider a relatively new perspective. I'm critical of those sorts of legal opinions that presidents have received. I hold the sort of to the main line of views, which is presidents have been deviating from the Constitution. But how to explain how that happened and how we get ourselves back to a better process, those are areas where I feel the scholarship has not been sufficient and has not been very good, really. So I'm trying to provide a more, dare I use this word, sophisticated appreciation of, although presidents have been, arguably from my perspective, doing wrong, they've also been acting with some democratic justification. And in any case, within the structure of a constitutional order in which many Americans not only believe, but still believe in. You have any people asking the presidential candidates these days, when will you give back war powers to Congress? Instead, people are more asking questions, you know, judged by the what presidents say. They're asking more questions of the nature, given we're in a new situation, it's been a long time since 9/11, but really they're still asking the question, how will you keep America safe? Right? So they have to respond to that. They have to say things like, I will preserve an adequate defense along these lines. And, of course, the candidates are in agreement. It's a good thing that, you know, Osama bin Laden is gone. But no one is really saying, Mr. President, we've got a big problem because the executive branch has too much power. Now, that perspective is very common in my area of the world, the con law area, and in political science departments. But it's not necessarily, doesn't resonate in any particular way with the public. Now, that's something I really concentrate on, that there's this gap between how the debate has evolved. Again, I agree with many different aspects of the scholarly critique of presidents, but what I don't agree with is the conclusion a lot of people immediately draw, which is that presidents have therefore, been acting illegally, and so we need to get back to the 18th century. I'm afraid there's no going back. We can do a better process, and certainly many would agree, we can have a better process than we have now. We certainly can't avoid all the mistakes in foreign policy. I hope we can generate a more democratic process, and that's what my book is intended to be a contribution toward. So since I have 7 chapters in the book, I could go on for at least 7 hours, but I'll spare you because I've given you the gist.